We haven't gotten the benefit of the deal. The deal was, it was a compromise, and it was supposed to be balanced, and it hasn't been.
Governor Walker defends the state's right to develop resources at a U.S. Senate hearing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, when rural Alaskans are released from prison, many are stuck in Anchorage to meet conditions of their parole.
It's hard being here in Anchorage, away from my family, the people I love.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
This week marks the 35th anniversary of a federal law that reshaped Alaska, literally redrawing the map. It's called the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. ANILCA created new preserves and refuges across the state. It nearly doubled the size of the national park system. It also set policy on subsistence, mining, drilling, and access to Alaska's public land. It's a complicated document that took years of negotiation, but at a congressional hearing today, Senator Lisa Murkowski and Governor Bill Walker said the federal government is not living up to its end of the bargain. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Murkowski convened the hearing as chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. ANILCA, she says, set aside lands for conservation but was supposed to leave the rest available for development. Murkowski read part of Jimmy Carter's description of the final bill.
100% of the offshore areas and 95% of the potentially productive oil and mineral areas will be available for exploration and development. What a promise that was.
Instead, the senator says federal agencies have closed off more and more federal lands to development. Governor Walker agrees.
We haven't gotten the benefit of the deal. The deal was, it was a compromise, and it was supposed to be balanced, and it hasn't been. The No More Clause has not been honored. We have not had the access that we should have had.
The No More Clause is a provision of ANILCA that says there are to be no more lands in Alaska withdrawn or set aside for conservation unless Congress approves. It even bans certain studies of public lands in Alaska for more conservation. All but one of the invited witnesses agreed that federal agencies regularly violate this no more promise. Some said the federal government is starving the Trans-Alaska pipeline of oil by, among other things, allowing rigs on only part of the National Petroleum Reserve. Walker says Alaska can't afford to lose the pipeline.
It would shut down Alaska. It would turn Alaska into something that we have not seen since prior to statehood. What a shame that would be because of lack of access to the resource.
State Senator John Coghill, a Republican from Fairbanks, brought up the BLM's move to expand their areas of critical environmental concern in the interior, which has alarmed gold miners in the 40-mile mining district. Coghill says these designations aren't allowed under ANILCA.
They're contrary to the law. They're being used by the agencies to treat areas of critical concern with the idea of looking at wilderness characteristics. It's another withdrawal. And it violates the No More Clause so significantly that it's blatant.
No one from the federal agencies was on the witness list. Murkowski said there wasn't enough time for all who wanted to weigh in. But Valerie Brown of the environmental law firm Trustees for Alaska was on the panel. Brown says ANILCA has been a huge success, bringing the state tens of thousands of jobs in outdoor recreation and billions in consumer spending. Brown says the other witnesses don't understand what the No More Clause really means.
It says that that there can't be any more studies for the single purpose of creating a new conservation system unit in Alaska. So that means we can't go to unrestricted federal lands and say, hey, we'd like a new national park here.
But Brown says where the federal government has already withdrawn lands in parks and refuges and the like, the agencies still have to manage those lands according to public land laws. As for the areas of critical environmental concern that Coghill spoke about, Brown argues the BLM's plan to expand them in Alaska is legal. Brown says the Federal Land Policy and Management Act requires the agency to look at all its lands and identify its most critical habitat.
Those are required by law. They're not withdrawals. They're the agency looking at its all of its land and saying, okay, under FLTMA, we have to decide where the most critical habitat is, and we're going to designate an ACEC here. It's not a withdrawal. It's still the same land designation and land withdrawal it was before.
It was a busy day in Congress, and Murkowski was the only senator present for most of the hearing. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state has given the green light for another year of work on the Alaska LNG project, the massive effort to bring natural gas from the North Slope to the Kenai Peninsula for export. Now state officials are waiting to hear back from Alaska's three partners in the project, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. The four partners must approve the budget for the coming year by tomorrow in order to continue work. Alaska's share of that budget comes to about $60 million. The board of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, which represents the state in the project, unanimously approved that amount, but only after delaying the vote twice to give state negotiators more time to hammer out agreements with the three oil companies. Acting Chair Dave Cruz said board members wanted to make sure they made the right call.
Working both with the Parnell administration and the Walker administration, a lot of times things are the 11th hour and the 58th minute.
Yeah.
And we have to make certain that the deals are right. This is huge dollars, and it's Alaska's future, and everyone was concerned that we're doing the right decisions.
The state's decision was originally expected on November 21st, but in the hours leading up to that meeting, Governor Bill Walker removed two board members and oversaw the ouster of the corporation's president. Walker said he didn't want the state to approve any more work until he had commitments from the three North Slope producers that should one of them withdraw, they would not scuttle the project by withholding the natural gas they control. After the board's vote Thursday afternoon, the governor's office announced it had agreements with BP and ConocoPhillips, though not with Exxon. Cruz said it made sense for the state to wait until the last minute to take its vote.
Remember, if anybody pulls out of this, the deal's done. That's how critical this is. So do you go in first or do you sit back and make sure everybody's driving their car over to that meeting or they're all sitting in the seats?
Assuming all three oil companies vote yes, the plan for the coming year calls for a preliminary planning and design work only. No final decision on whether to actually build the pipeline is expected before 2018. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Chilkat robe that was on eBay returns to Southeast Alaska.
It's a blanket made out of mountain goat wool and cedar bark. And it takes about a year to make.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
People around the United States who are leaving prison all face similar challenges. Sometimes it's harder to find work or a place to live when you have a criminal history. But some people from rural Alaska face a unique barrier. Their conditions of parole prevent them from going home. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned more for our series, Hitting Reset.
Stanley Mute arrives 15 minutes early for the interview, his black hair dyed even darker to conceal any hints of gray. He's uncertain about getting his point across.
English is real hard for me. That's my secondary language. My words don't really come out like how you want to hear. So But I do speak in my language real good.
Mute's first language is Yupik. He's from the coastal village of Kogiganek. What he can't communicate through words, he can through his art. He taught himself to draw when he was in prison. At first, he just decorated envelopes because he was bored and sold them for $1 apiece to get money for coffee. Then, other prisoners started requesting larger drawings to send home and paying extra to get them sooner. Mute says all of the images, which range from hunters and kayaks to cartoons of animals, come from his imagination and stories he's been told.
I replayed them in my mind and start drawing them how I heard the stories.
Mute picks up a copy of his favorite drawing, a Yupik dancer. Thousands of tiny strokes of varying shades of green radiate from the figure.
He does everything, helping out people, encouraging other people. That's why there's a came out from the other side.
It's like he's jumping from the light.
Yeah.
And dancing in the light. Yeah.
And that's what happy people do, right?
Mute isn't sure. After nearly 20 years in prison for sexual assault, he's struggling to make it in Anchorage, a city he's never lived in before. He's required to stay here to receive alcohol abuse and sex offender treatment. But at 51 years old, he doesn't have the skills to make it in the city. He's trying not to worry about what's happening to his family and friends back in the village and things he can't control.
I worry about is how am I going to live? How am I going to start doing, you know, what normal people do?
Marlon Sukiak asks himself similar questions. In Anchorage, he's working as a janitor in the place where he lives. Back home in Chaktulik, before he pled guilty and went to jail for incest in 2011, he was a welder, a commercial fisherman, and a community leader. Before he can go back, he has to finish his treatment.
The treatment I receive here in Anchorage is hour and a half a week, 6 hours a month, and 72 hours a year. That's what it boils down to.
What Sukiak and others are asking is, why can't he do that treatment from home?
It's hard being here in Anchorage, away from my family, the people I love, my relations, and, you know, and when I could be doing a lot more back home and providing for the people I love so much over there. And
recidivism rates for Alaska Natives are 10% higher than for the offender population as a whole. Rebecca Brunger is the operations manager for the Probation and Parole Division of the Department of Corrections. She says that the barriers for people wanting to go back to their villages are very real, but the department also must consider the needs of the victims.
It's a very tough balance, keeping somebody in a community where it's going to be difficult for them to succeed versus sending them back to a community where potentially they are just as dangerous as they were when they left, or maybe more dangerous.
Research shows sex offender treatment does reduce recidivism for sexual and violent crimes, but it's more effective when it's tailored to the needs of the individual offenders. Reentry advocates say current sex offender treatment methods aren't adapted for Alaska Native cultures and rely on confrontational models that aren't culturally appropriate. One Yupik treatment program does exist in Bethel, but it's extremely small. Carrie Belden is the director of probation and parole. She says offenders need to get treatment before going back.
We can't take a person who is unhealthy at that time and put them back into the community they just came from in the same exact situation without extra tools in their toolbox and expect something different.
The Department of Corrections doesn't have the resources to make sex offender or other types of treatment available throughout the state, but they are looking into telemedicine options. For people like Stanley Mute, the time can't come soon enough. After our interview, he violated the conditions of his parole and is back in prison. Before he went back, he said he had one major goal.
All I want to do is probably go back to my village, and that's where I should be. I mean, get old there.
He wants to hunt, pick berries, and spend time doing the subsistence activities he draws images of, but hasn't done himself since 1995. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
You can see some of Stanley Mute's work in the Community in Unity Art Show and Portrait Series in the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage through December. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta has a new Alaska State Troopers unit this week. The unit's main goal is to investigate violent crimes faster so reports can make it to the district attorney's desk more quickly. The Violent Offenders Unit officially began Tuesday after the team was kick-started in mid-September, and their caseload is already nearing 70. Teig Whittemeyer is the sergeant leading the new three-person unit. He, along with the two patrol troopers on the team, have a combined experience of more than 40 years on the force. He says he's excited to be a part of the unit, but acknowledges their caseload is already overwhelming.
This unit has a total of, we've handled 69 cases. So out of those 69 cases, and that's been between the two troopers and myself, we have worked diligently with the individuals and the families and the district attorney's office on these cases, but it has been somewhat a little overwhelming.
The unit focuses on investigating crimes of sexual assault and child sex abuse. Their duties include interviewing perpetrators, victims, and witnesses, as well as transporting survivors to Bethel for sexual assault evidence exams or rape kits and other medical needs. Trooper Captain Barry Wilson oversees the Bethel Trooper Post. He says some variation of the unit has been in discussion for years.
So it's kind of been in this transitional thought process. We knew we wanted to do something different. We just weren't sure what that would look like and what that will ultimately look like.
Wilson says centralizing the investigations to one unit will relieve other patrol troopers so they can focus on their other duties. A state advisory board is recommending Alaska Governor Bill Walker hike the aviation fuel tax to support rural airports. The Aviation Advisory Board weighed several options in its efforts to offset cuts to the Department of Transportation, but as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, there is no certainty any additional revenue would support the airports.
Faced with declining oil revenue and cuts to the Department of Transportation, Governor Walker charged the Aviation Advisory Board this summer with recommendations for covering the upkeep of almost 250 airports scattered across the state. These airports don't include international hubs of Fairbanks and Anchorage, and most don't have any personnel and few pieces of equipment. Jim Dodson is vice chair of the board. He says it seemed raising the jet and aviation fuel tax to 10 cents a gallon was the fairest option.
What type of structure could we come up with that would impact aviation users of our aviation system equally? And what type of system could we come up with that wouldn't cost us anything additional to collect?
John Binder is deputy commissioner for aviation for DOT. He says it costs the state roughly $37 million to run rural airports. About $5 million comes in on rentals and fees to offset that. He says a 10-cent a gallon cost represents triple the current tax for jet fuel and double for aviation fuel. But he says even if lawmakers and the governor sign off on the tax hike, there's no guarantee it would aid rural airports.
That would require legislative action as well to dedicate that money specifically to the airport system or to DOT, and that's fairly unlikely, I think.
So with the governor urging rural airports to be more self-supporting, the recommended route is in for a bumpy ride in Juneau. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
A Chilkat robe that was for sale on eBay has returned to Southeast Alaska. The robe traveled all the way from Texas, where it was almost sold to the highest bidder. Instead, the Alaska Heritage Institute welcomed it home on Tuesday. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins was at the ceremony and filed this report.
A crowd packed the Red Cedar Clan house at the Walter Soboleff Building downtown. Klinkit, Haida, and Simshian gathered together. The ceremony began with two songs of mourning, one eagle, the other raven. The Chilkat robe was brought out in a cardboard FedEx box and unfurled to reveal a black and yellow design.
It's a blanket made out of mountain goat wool and cedar bark. And it takes about a year to make.
SHI President Rosita Worrell says the Klan crest could be a thunderbird or a hawk, but the organization isn't sure. They were able to purchase the robe from the eBay seller at the base price. Blankets like these can fetch upwards of $30,000. SHI paid over $14,000. When the seller was informed about the item's significance, Worrell said he worked with SHI to make sure it was returned. She hadn't seen the Chilkat blanket until this moment.
You know, I mean, I wish I had, because when I first saw it, I was just so overcome that I could barely, you know, make the opening remarks.
Dorothy Gregory came to the ceremony because she says she wanted to see the weaving.
I am happy to see that it is here.
She said she knows this is one of many blankets that's been taken out of Alaska.
My grandmother's blanket was one of them. So we look forward to someday seeing it again, you know.
George Blucher, the seller of the blanket, couldn't be reached for comment. But in a statement, he said he purchased it at a flea market in Illinois. SHI believes it could have been a funerary object due to the fraying at the ends. The ceremony closed with dancing and a joyous song. Clan leader David Katzik called the robe an amazing technology. But unlike your tablet or iPhone, he said this kind isn't isolating. It's known as A'u.
That which was paid for with our lives. That's the reason why we have an intimacy. And it could be misrepresented when people are saying our ancestors came home. When we're saying that, we're talking about that technology that generates a very intimate way of thinking about family, about each other.
In the future, weavers and artists will be invited to study the blanket at SHI. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Homer High School is hosting a student from the West African country of Cameroon this year, and as part of his exchange program, 11th grader Nuruddin Mama is visiting schools and churches. Recently, he visited the school in the Russian Old Believer community of Nikolaevsk, just outside Homer. KBBI's Deja Eaton tagged along and has this report.
I can write Arab, but I can't speak yet.
Nuruddin Mama stands at the front of the classroom wearing a white tunic and pants, with a black hat and a red, green, and yellow scarf, the colors of the Cameroonian flag, the name of his country printed in bright yellow letters. He fields questions from a room full of curious students. They ask him how to say something in his traditional language of Hausa.
So good morning is inakwana, and in French is bonjour.
One student then offers how to say good morning in Russian.
In Russian, it's Dobre utro.
Why is it long?
The day was full of such exchanges. The 16-year-old is attending Homer High School, serving as an ambassador from his country through the Kennedy Luger Youth Exchange and Study Program, also known as the YES Program, which was established by Congress in 2002 in response to September 11th. Russian Orthodox people came to Nikolaevsk, about 25 miles north of Homer, around 1968. The town has a population of about 300, and around a quarter of them are school age. Most have never met an African. Mama speaks Hausa, plus French and English at home with his father, mother, and four siblings. He lives in a suburb of Douala, Cameroon's largest city. He also knows some Arabic and is learning Spanish. He says he's excited about the opportunity to share his culture with Alaskans and to learn about theirs. Mama says he enjoys learning about other faiths and going to a Christian church with his host family in Anchor Point.
I'm quite happy, glad that I am with Christian.
He says he doesn't mind being, as far as he can tell, the only Muslim in Homer and one of the few people of color. And he likes school here.
My favorite subjects are physics, chemistry, math, and art.
Mama also likes Justin Bieber, soccer, and basketball. He's fond of his smartphone and enjoys Facebook. He says he'd like to attend college in the U.S., and he eventually wants to be a doctor or a petrochemist. Mama says it's through small day-to-day interactions with people in Alaska that he hopes to help create cultural understanding.
Today, I went to school, and I met one of my friends that I posted something in Facebook written inshallah, and inshallah means if God wills. And I like the way he came to me and asked me what does it means, and he wanted me to explain it to him, and I explained it to him, and he was glad.
After Mama's talk, some of the Russian Old Believer students gather around to chat more casually. 11th grader Elena Gordeev says she was surprised to learn that Cameroon was such a diverse and peaceful place.
I really like that there's so much diversity. There's 200 different ethnic groups and languages and stuff like that. I found that very interesting. I found it very interesting that it was peaceful with that much diversity, and to have peace is pretty cool.
And the students also talked about similarities between Russian Old Believers and Muslims in Cameroon, like how women from both cultures dress traditionally in long dresses with their heads covered. Heather Pankratz, who teaches middle school and high school English and history at Nikolaevsk, says having students like Mama visit contributes to her students' understanding of the world.
I think it's important because a lot of times we don't get out of the state very often as, you know, villagers, and I think it's important for them to recognize that people are the same wherever they go, and different, and there's unique things about people that make them special.
There are 10 YES students in Alaska right now from Egypt, Gaza, Indonesia, Kuwait, Tunisia, Turkey, and Yemen. Mama is the only YES student in Alaska from Cameroon. He's visited several schools and a church in the Homer area, and he says he'll go wherever he's invited. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholtz and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Lakhedra Chavis in Bethel, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Daisha Eaton in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
On Thursday, December 3rd, Alaska Pacific University is hosting an open house from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in the Carr Gottstein Lobby. Learn about environmental science, outdoor and environmental education, and K-8 teaching certification programs. To find out where these APU programs can take you, hashtag ThisIsOurClassroom. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.